Netcasting from Chicago, Los Angeles, and Sydney, you're listening to this week's FX Podcast from FXGuide.com.
Hi, thanks for downloading this week's podcast. I'm John Montgomery. Our focus this week is on the animated short film, Madame Tootley Pootley. It's a film which was actually nominated for an Academy Award in the animated short film category. The Oscars coming up, of course, on February 24th. But before we get into that, I just want to give a shout-out to the winners of the 6th Annual VES Awards. For a full listing, you can check out our website in the Quick Take section, but the main ones, the Transformers won for Outstanding Visual Effects in a VFX-driven motion picture. For Outstanding Supporting Visual Effects in a Motion Picture, the winner was Ratatouille. For Broadcast Miniseries, Movie, or Special, Battlestar Galactica won again. Great visual effects, of course, in that series and miniseries. For Visual Effects in a Broadcast Series, Fight for Life, Episode 4 won. In a Broadcast Program, it was Rome, Episode 6. And for Outstanding Visual Effects in a Commercial, Smirnoff C1. Again, there's more winners than that, but if you want to check those out, be sure to check out the Quick Take section over at Effects Guide. Now, I think you're really going to enjoy our conversation this week for the podcast. Mike Seymour spoke with Jason Walker, who created a cool new effect for the animated film Madame Tootley Pootley. It's a blending of traditional stop-motion techniques, but the interesting fact was tracking in human eyes into the characters in the film, and it really gave it a breadth and depth that you obviously couldn't get with practical eyes. The other interesting thing, and you guys may think we're doing a string of After Effects stories, and I guess in a way we are, but it did all the compositing and so forth in After Effects, which is quite brilliant, especially considering the amount of masking and so forth that he did, and you'll hear about that in the podcast. So why don't we go ahead and join the conversation Mike Seymour had with Jason Walker about Madame Tootley Pootley.
Thanks, John. And Jason, we're incredibly enthusiastic to be talking to you on the other side of the planet. Where are you right now?
I'm in Toronto, Canada at the moment, where most of the movie was shot. And I presently live just outside the city in the country, in the woods, which I quite like. But today I'm in the city. We're about to leave for the airport tomorrow, so tonight I'm in the city.
Is that for the Oscar function? And
Yeah, it's the Academy Luncheon, which is on Monday, February the 4th, and the two directors, Chris Maciek, the actress Laurie Marr, and myself are going to be attending that, which is very exciting, and this year could be the only real celebration for Oscars this year. Who knows?
Yeah, I mean, congratulations on the Academy Award nomination. It's a terrific acknowledgement of the work that you've done.
Thank you very much, Mike. It really is quite an honor. We feel a little bit, I suppose everyone feels a little bit like they're it's not undeserving, or it's not feeling like that, but it's just like, you know, you wonder about all the people that attend these things, and it really is quite an honor. I think that we're actually still all shocked, actually. That's probably the best answer.
Now, Canada has a very long tradition of producing outstanding animation, and I guess that's in part due historically to the Canadian Film Board, correct?
Oh, yes, I think so indeed. Oh, yeah.
But tell me, how did you get involved with this project?
Well, for quite a few years prior to any mention of Tootley Pootley, I was friends with the directors, Chris and Maciek. And I would say that probably about 4 years before we started Tootley, we got together, first of all, upon their first animation job, really. They were illustrators, and I was an artist illustrator in the city, and we got to know each other, and then they were offered their first commercial animation, which was for Bell Canada, Christmas ad, and they needed to do a stop-motion animation of a package opening, and they didn't know anything about computer graphics, and I didn't really either at the time, but my wife at the time and I were just getting into playing around with animation at home on our Mac, and she was a graphic designer for TV, so it was a sort of natural leap to start trying animation. So I accepted to try this little job with Chris and Maciek, and And it worked out really good. They did the foreground, I did the background, and it was good fun. And they're fun guys to be around, so we all had a laugh. And then after that, they started to do more animation jobs for the Space Channel in Toronto, sort of like a sci-fi network. And Global Television launched the Mystery Channel. And really, Chris and Maciek really liked to concentrate on the theme that they want and the story. And at that point, they didn't really want to spend a lot of time figuring out alpha channels and so on. So it was good for the three of us. We all enjoyed our tasks. And we did this for a few years. I was still painting in my own time and doing other jobs. And this was just something that we evolved more and more. Each job was more complicated and we were learning as we went. And then I think towards the end of 2002, Chris Maciek decided that they wanted to fulfill a dream of theirs, I think, which was to make a movie with the National Film Board of Canada. So they had their story in mind, and they had storyboarded some of it. And then I believe that they had gotten the initial interest of the National Film Board, but had not made their presentation quite yet. So we decided one day that the three of us would just get together and talk about this new project and what we could do in order to try and make this film look like it had more money spent on it than it really did. and at that point, I think everyone had seen Gollum, I think, for the first time about then, obviously a CG solution. And we actually joked that we need a something that looks as good as Gollum, but on a poor man's budget. So at that point, we were on the heels of just finishing an animation for a drive-in channel, drive-in movies. And Chris and Maciek had animated like an old-style drive-in movie, things like popcorn and a drink and so on, sort of walking along, singing and dancing, and animated the arms and so on separately, and then I would composite them on. But we had a unique problem that the network that wanted this animated had a specific song, and they ran into the classic issue of lip-syncing and how easy this would be or how difficult. So we started talking about the possibility of filming a real mouse. And at that point, the box of singing popcorn actually just was doing two moves. It would just go from A to B back to A again. So it was quite an easy rhythm, and it was in time with music. So we filmed Maciek's mouse singing the song. And Chris and Maciek sort of cleaned away the tracking dot that they'd put on their box of popcorn, which was huge. And, we were learning. So they did the paintwork to get rid of that. And then we stuck the mouse on there. We just tracked it on quite simply, did a little bit of color correction, and it looked good enough. It didn't really have to look real at all because it's popcorn, but it certainly solved the issue. So we had that in our minds during this meeting about Tootley, and we started thinking, well, is there anything else that we could track to the face or something that would give this character or this film. I don't think we were that specific yet about what we were going to do, but we just started thinking about what could be done with the existing software that we had, with the computers that we had, which were Mac G4s with After Effects, basically just off-the-shelf After Effects without any special plugins. I think the only plugin we used was DVMAT Pro. So we basically thought about a few different solutions, mice again, obviously, and then we arrived inevitably on the eyes. And if I remember right, Chris told me afterwards that he was the sane one, and he realized that it was not possible. Like, if it was possible, we would have seen it by now, to be able to seamlessly track eyes. And it's not just compositing eyes. I think that the trick is to try and make it look seamless. And I know that other people have done things like this with music videos, but it's making it seamless, I think, that really pulls off the effect. So,
of course, they say that the eyes are the window under the soul, and certainly the mood that it creates by having such powerful performances from the eyes is incredible. But tell me, I'm really keen to drill down on the process because as you say, it's not as simple as just tracking them on, because a tracking solution would presume that the eyes were flat and that they were tracking onto a flat face. And, of course, your characters are turning and are looking up and down, and so there's a three-dimensionality to where the eyes have to move. So let's start with what came first. Did you do the claymation and then match the eyes, or did you do the performance from the actor and then match the stop-frame animation?
Well, what happened actually was after that meeting, we decided that we were going to try eyes. And I believe at that point we had an actual actress that they had chosen as their inspiration. Not in a very detailed way at first. They just knew that they were going to have to animate a woman, and these, you know, two guys wanted to make sure that they could animate a feminine character authentically. So they used the actress Laurie Marr from Toronto, who came in a few times, and they asked her to, you know, walk around, and they videotaped her just to get her character. And Laurie did such a good job, and she really knew that character so well that they filmed her doing other things like talking on the phone, and realized that if they created a nice video animatic of the majority of the film with Laurie, they could manage to capture the essence of her body language as well. And so they had her in mind already for that. So we said, well, let's bring her in, and I'll put makeup on her, and we'll try a test puppet. And so Kristen Maciek developed a tiny little test Madame Tootley Pootley with a paper hat with no eyes. And we decided that we were going to animate this puppet doing three moves over about 120 frames. And so we did that, and then had Laurie come in after. The puppet was always filmed first, and then Laurie would come in, and I would analyze the puppet footage that existed, and I would break the puppet moves down into colors on a timeline. So they're very visual for me to see and everyone else involved in the filming of the eyes. So Laurie would come in at that point, and I would teach her those moves. And at that point, that was as intricate as we were going to get. And I actually said, when you're filming the puppets from now on, try not to make them move too much. That's going to make this entire job a lot more complicated. And so we had the puppet footage test. Then we had the test eyes of Laurie shot. Took about five or six takes, and she just did her best to keep the moves, and we really didn't know exactly what we were in store for yet. So I took this away, and I had this idea in mind. I knew that somehow this could be done with a three-step process of tracking. Then I thought stabilization, but that never ended up really helping. And then time remapping. In fact, very extreme time remapping. So so I went away for about 3 months back to where I work. This was done at their studio, and I went back home to play around in After Effects to see if this would work. And after about 3 months, I developed this system of selecting only the frames from the video take that actually could reconstruct the emotion and more importantly the angles that the puppet is moving at. And so when I went back with the finished test a few months later, I went back to their studio to see how they were doing, and they had continued to film puppet scenes, and I'd imagined that all these puppet scenes were not moving any more than two or three moves. And when I got there, they had filmed scenes where the puppet was doing absolutely everything with 10 moves or 15 moves, all with no eyes. And, of course, the puppet is on a train, so that means that the light coming in the window is flickering. And in fact, they developed a little thing that you can spin for every frame that causes a completely random flicker on everything that's in the cabin of the train, including the puppet's face. So it was about as much of a nightmare as you could want, you know? And So I said, okay, well, luckily, this system I've come up with should be able to handle multiple moves after all. So we were lucky there. And
so when you moved to having the far more complicated moves, was the way that you were dealing with the live-action video footage the same? I mean, how were you dealing with that?
At that point, I decided I was going to need a new system of breaking down the complicated scenes that they had shot. So within After Effects, I'd create a thing called a Wunderbar, which just a funny name we made up for these strange timelines that I had created for each puppet scene. And what I would do is have a timeline going along the bottom of a cropped puppet scene, and I would individually separate the moves into these little colors and work out every time there was going to be a flash of light or a shadow that passes on the puppet. I would actually indicate that on the Wunderbar as a little transparent color on top of the color of the move. And so by creating these charts, I was able to break down just what was needed for each day of filming. And also the actors and actresses could not film more than about 6 head moves at a time. It's just too much to remember. So if there was a puppet scene that lasted, 10 or 15 moves, I'd have to actually break that Wunderbar into segments and film only, choreograph and film only about 6 moves at a time, and then take a break, learn the next 6 moves, and afterwards when I'm compositing that in the computer, I actually have to join it. So the way of taking selected frames only from all of this video footage, and you're recompiling the animation, so it's not really a system of just compositing video of eyes onto the puppet. You're actually starting with video, and you're actually going through it and reanimating only the frames that you need and only the frames that match. So by doing so, you can actually change the acting a little bit in terms of, a blink. I would have video of a blink that lasts, 20 frames, but the puppet, I can have her blink in 5 frames and create a completely different kind of blink. So, you can determine by the frames that you choose how long the Madame Tootley-Pootley stares at a certain thing on the train and so on. And you're actually you're trapped also within your moves. I mean, as soon as she moves, you're then on to the your frames that require an angle change, and that's why the light flashes and the shadow passes and the way that the light changes on her face as she moves around the scene. You actually have to try and film all as much of that in camera as you can, and so you go quite slowly. You just can't do the video take in real time as it is with the puppet. You concentrate more on getting the angles right, the lights right, the emotions and the acting, and then afterwards I decide which frames I'm going to use for the puppet.
And you said you were basically compositing in After Effects. Were you putting those contact lighting past, the fact that it would be shadows and stuff, were they all done therefore in camera, or were you just applying color correction in After Effects to match it to what was going on inside the train?
I would say it was about an even mix of both. There was definitely in-camera advantages, especially with eyes, because you have the pupil, changing and so on from one eye to the next as well. So there's all these things about eyes that that we're all experts on just by way of being human. We've been, looking at eyes all of our life, and as soon as there's something even slightly wrong, the entire illusion is blown. So I decided that early on, really the best way to really make those eyes look like they were on the puppet all the time is to have as many real light effects as possible. Even tiny little, just tiny little flickers, you'd be surprised at how much they'll bounce in the wetness of the eye and so on. So I made sure I included as much as I thought was manageable when I created the timeline for each scene. The Wunderbar, I would actually determine at that point what needed to be in camera and what didn't. The things that were not in camera were many, many of the very, very slight flickers. I mean, because it's stop motion, you're going to have a minute flicker anyway on top of this effect.
Were you doing the flicker matching by eye, or did you have something that analyzed for the flicker?
What's that, sorry?
Did you analyze the levels to get the flicker, or did you just do it by hand and by eye?
Oh, it was all done. It was all done by eye, actually. I developed a couple of little handy things along the way. One of them was some of the very, very minute flickers that happen in the area around the eyes. I would say that in most scenes, the brightness, contrast, and color level filters in After Effects there was a keyframe for almost every frame of the scene. I mean, it fluctuates very slightly in every single frame. And if you don't do that, it's simply not going to look like it's there. It's going to look like it's floating on the surface. So you really do have to go in every single frame and just adjust it here and there, just ever so slightly. And then one of the little tricks I came up with was to actually take a piece of the scene, take a piece of the puppet scene somewhere, quite usually the seat behind her or something like that. And that is flickering in the scene, obviously. And what I would do is I would take a little section of the seat, turn it black and white, bump up the contrast on it, and then I would overlay that as a color overlay with a certain opacity just in the mask of where the eye is. And sometimes that was just enough to actually meld the eye one more level to the scene by just giving it this a loan of something else.
Yeah,
in the scene.
Great when you can sort of sample the natural flicker. But to me, I've got one really key question. We've got obviously the eyes tracked onto the face. We've discussed that in the broad terms, but in the specific, are you doing each eye separately? Because surely not only do you have the orientation that the eyes are, but even the slightest head tilt would mean that the eyes would no longer be correct relative to each other.
Exactly.
So
that was one of the challenges was to retain the cohesiveness of the eyes, in the sense that when they're looking at you, they're not cross-eyed or so on, but at the same time, they each did have to be added individually, and each eye is also stretched slightly taller to make her look slightly more sympathetic, and that in itself was borderline problematic, in the sense that when the if Tootley, for example, turns her head almost horizontally, that eye is going to be wide, right, rather than tall. So in a way, there's a minute swimming effect that's happening there, but luckily you can't really see that. But yes, each eye was done individually, and I could tell you a bit more in detail why. Or how, I suppose, because what I would do is, when I first started to do this, the first few scenes, I was figuring it out as I went along, the more, because of these complicated scenes that we had done. And what I would do is I would have the masks that are basically cutting away the rest of the video of the face, leaving me with just the eyes. I would have those masks on the same layer as the eye footage, which was a mistake because that eye is has to be hand-placed for every frame. As you said earlier, the computer doesn't know it's an eye and it doesn't know it's changing angles. It just treats it as a flat piece. So you're the person who has to actually move it minutely for every single frame, rotation as well, and scale in some scenes. I suppose at that point it's regular compositing. But what I would have to do eventually is create all my masks on a separate layer, and then invert that layer out of the eye layer. And the reason for that is the footage of the eye itself is moving around so much, it's keyframed so much in order to keep it locked onto the face, that you know, your masks are going to be moving everywhere and you've got to move all them every frame. So by having your masks on a separate layer, and that separate layer is a child to a target. I know I'm getting complicated here, Mike, but there's not really
a great
way of describing it. It is complicated. What I would do is I would track a target to the puppet. The puppet had a tiny little black dot where the eyes should be, and I would track a master target that was on its own layer, and that was just a little target that I made in Illustrator. And that layer would serve as most things would piggyback onto that layer at some point in the process. So that target had to be tracked by hand. I tried for a while to use After Effects tracking ability that it has, and it's good, but it's just not good enough for eyes because it moves around a little bit, and that's just enough of a jitter to cause you to have to go through it all again and keyframe it. So what I would do is I would hand track the target for the frames to the puppet. Then that target would be a layer in my After Effects, and then I would have the video footage of the eyes, and they would be hand placed too, like you say, one at a time, in order to overcome all the unique angle changes and so on. They do actually move around a little bit in order to fool you, and so I would afterwards I would create all my masks on a third layer, and for each eye there could be anywhere between 4 masks or up to 10 or 15 masks. It depends on how close the scene was and how many angle changes the eyes go through. And I know that, for example, Shake has multiple feather abilities on one mask, and that would have been handy, but we started with After Effects, and I stuck with it for the 4 years, and I got quite used to having, you know, multiple masks for each eye, all different colors, so I knew which one was which. Each one had a different feather, and each one was individually keyframed to move around. But I would have that layer of masks painted to the target. So in a way, the target did a lot of the work for the masks. I would not have to keyframe every mask for every frame. There was times when I would only have to put a keyframe in every 5 or 10 frames because the target was carrying that layer for me. And that really helped. I figured that one out pretty quickly.
But you mentioned there that carried you for 4 years. Is it 4 years is how long you were doing the project?
Yeah, actually, because we were doing this on a poor man's budget, we had no teams of people. Right at the beginning, Chris and Maciek had interns from from Toronto's art school to come in and help with the making of bags and little props and so on. But when it came to the eye effect, it was really just the filming of the eyes at the beginning. The three of us would work out a lot of those problems together, and but beyond that, I did the entire process myself, and I think that's probably why it took so long.
It's really produced such a poignant and sad kind of performance that it's obviously worth it, and it's terrific. But I have some other things that have been dying to ask you as well, because while I was watching and obviously mainly focused on the great compositing work you did for The Eyes, there must have been surely a bunch of other things in the film that you're also doing. I mean, for example, the guy's playing chess, and when the chess pieces sort of flip up through the air, I mean, was there a lot of rig removal in the film overall? Was most of the stuff in camera?
We had a great intern come in for a little while. Over the 4 years towards the end, I think in the final year, Chris Imacek managed to get a grant to find one person to come in for a few months for a lot of the digital cleanup and so on, a lot of wire removal and things like that. And his name was Peter George, and he's a great guy. He's a young guy. He does a lot of compositing work for IMAX, actually. And he was great to have around there for a few months. He's a fun guy, so we enjoyed that. And he did a great job of removing some fairly hefty wires that come out of Tootley's head when she's running down the hallway of the train. And he also took out the reflections of the wire that are in the wall on either side as well. So he really did a great job there, and I think that's another reason why those scenes of her running look so great, because someone really took time to take out all the telltale signs.
Give me the technical specs on what you were working at. What was it shot on, and what resolution were you doing the post at?
I was wondering if you'd ask me that, Mike.
I know it was 4 years ago.
It's been a bit of time since I was finished, and I'm not really as technical as maybe some of the other people you've interviewed about these things. We sort of made it up as we went along, and I couldn't tell you specifically some of these things. All I know is that they used a 10 megapixel still digital camera to take the frames for the puppets. So the scenes that they would compile from there, once I got them, they were quite big. They were way bigger than we required. The finished result was going to be 35 millimeter. But these were huge. They're easily 2,500 pixels by 3,000 pixels. I mean, they were quite big.
But you worked at 2K resolution when you were doing all your work?
Yeah, I worked at the full resolution, and the resolution changed. They went through about three cameras over the years, so towards the end, the resolution was even bigger than the beginning. So, and I kept working at the full resolution. I thought that would always give the best result either way, and then we'd shrink it down afterwards. So we ran into some issues at the beginning with the cameras that we used for filming the eyes. For faraway scenes, we would use a Canon GL1, which is just regular resolution, and we knew that we would never be able to film the close-up eyes with that camera. Just would never match the quality of the puppet animation. But luckily, about that time, Sony came out with their first consumer HD camera. I can't remember the name of it right now, but it was their first one, and it was quite big. And a great guy that we know called Craig Small, who runs an animation place around the corner, he actually bought that camera and allowed us to use it anytime we wanted to film all of the HD close-ups of the eyes. Within that, there was a couple of problems. We had some interlacing every once in a while. We really didn't know what we were doing sometimes. we certainly knew what we were doing when it came to filming and so on, but sometimes we looked at the gear we were using and we were still trying to figure out what half of this stuff meant. So some scenes, actually, if you look carefully, you might actually see a little bit of interlacing artifact in every once in a while, which is very amateurish, but that's...
I think the joys of independent filmmaking are, amongst many others, is the learning process.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, like I say, Chris and Maciek, they started out as animators, as illustrators, as I did. And, you know, we just, it's that time, I think, when we can all do these things at home, you know. I mean, really, Tootly Pootly was made mostly in their studio, but towards the end, you know, I was just sitting at home on my Mac, doing this, and
here you are about to head off to Los Angeles for the Oscars.
Another reason why it's a bit of a surprise, you know. It's sort of like I was saying at the beginning, you kind of feel like that you must have conned people or something when you realize, actually, I suppose we did work on this for 4 years.
There's no doubt in my mind that it's the depth of the performances that has garnished such praise on the film. And again, no doubt in my mind that one of the things that's so pivotal to getting those sort of very strong performances is having the mix of the live action eyes with the claymation. And I must admit, the second that I saw it and heard about it, I was like, oh my God, why hasn't somebody done something on this scale before? Because it just works so well. So congratulations yeah. on the film. Congratulations. It's already gone very well at the awards festivals. But yeah. Hopefully it'll go well again for you at the main Academy Award event.
Yeah, I'd like to say actually that the actors that we used were really great. We obviously Laurie Marr, and we used an actor from Cirque du Soleil called Eric Goulem, and he played the pervert on the train, the little finger trick that he does, and so we put fake eyebrows on him, and they were all great because they really had to come up with something that hadn't been done before, which was to act, but at the same time, control your head very, very strictly, and listen to usually me going through the numbers of the moves and then calling out the lights and shadows and so on. But at the same time, they had to really watch their emotions for their performance, and then they had Chris and Maciek obviously encouraging their performance as well, which I think they did a great job of, to actually draw out of their eyes, just their eyes, not their rest of their face, but to try and tell the story with just these eyes. So sometimes the emotion of the puppet would be, let's say, happy. When Tootly Pootly waves at the little boy on the train, we filmed that and we had Laurie smile. But when I brought the eyes in afterwards and I looked, they looked like she was snarling. It just doesn't work when the cheeks don't move.
Because you've got a disconnection between the rest of the face and just the eyes, and to a certain extent the rest of the face set up the context upon which you read the eyes as being happy. Yeah. I can see that exactly. Did you get any happy accidents the other way where you found that the claymation actually gave a even better, more interesting, I guess maybe not better, but more interesting interpretation to the eyes once they were combined?
I think that in a way the puppet looks naturally sad. So sometimes Laurie didn't have to look quite as sad for the puppet to look like that. I think that one of the magical things about the puppet's face was that when she needs to look sad, nothing changes with the mouth. The eyes really change all of the face. And then later when the eyes are happy looking, you would swear that the mouth on the puppet has changed and it actually is smiling slightly. So the puppet actually is kind of a neutral canvas. And when you put the eyes on it, depending on what you choose to do with the eyes, you can change the whole face. So in a way, yeah, it does help. It's like a neutral playing board, you know. You can do what you want with it.
Well, thank you again for taking time to talk to us. We really do appreciate it.
No problem. I I listen to your podcast quite often, so I was glad to talk to you, and I knew that this would be an opportunity to try and talk a bit more in detail about what was done. When you do something like this, I'm sure other compositors have run into this before. The better a job you do, the more invisible it is, and I'm still reading articles out there about how well made this puppet is. So I'm glad I had an opportunity to talk to people like me who do crazy things like this, because we're the only people really that appreciate it at the end of the day. So I'm glad I got to tell you in more detail about what I came up with. So I'm glad you like it. Thank you.
Well, thanks for that, guys. Like I guess we sat down and checked out the short film. We'd seen it before. We checked it out again when we were at Sundance, Mike and I together. And I related to him that I actually remember growing up and, you know, 10 years old in southern Indiana and watching a series, or monthly series, I think it was, on animated shorts on the public television station. It was actually an incredible compilation every week of animated shorts from around the world. But honest to God, I remember a lot of the films being done by and being sponsored by the Film Board of Canada. They do really a fantastic job of supporting film in Canada, and I think especially animated short films, really great. So again, kudos to them, and congrats to Jason and the entire crew for Madame Tuli-Puli for the nomination in the short film category. Well, that's it for this week. Again, we love hearing from our listeners. So if you have any questions or comments about the podcast, be sure to drop by our forums or drop us a line on the website. For my partners and co-founders of FX Guide, Mike Seymour and Jeff Huser, I'm John Montgomery. Thanks for listening.
Please let us know if you have any suggestions for stories or future podcasts. You can reach us by using the Contact Us links at the top of the homepage. This podcast is copyright 2008 FX Guide LLC. Broadcast or redistribution is prohibited without the expressed written consent of FX Guide.